trees, and in a clearing were two canoes. Chevy guided the John boat to the clearing. Nate quickly jumped ashore, anxious to stretch his legs and feel the earth. "Stay close," Chevy warned as he switched gas tanks in the boat. Nate looked at him. Their eyes met, and Chevy nodded to the trees. An Indian was watching them. A male, brown-skinned, bare-chested, with a straw skirt of some sort hanging from his waist, no visible weapon. The fact that he was unarmed helped immensely, because Nate was at first terrified of him. The Indian had long black hair and red stripes on his forehead, and if he'd been holding a spear, Nate would have surrendered without a word. "Is he friendly?" he asked, without taking his eyes off the man. "I think so." "Does he speak Portuguese?" "I don't know. Why don't you go find out?" "Relax." Chevy stepped from the boat. "He looks like a cannibal," he whispered. The attempt at humor didn't work. They took a few steps toward the Indian, and he took a few steps toward them. All three stopped, with a nice gap in the center. Nate was tempted to raise the palm of his hand and say, "Howdy!"
"Fala Português," Chevy said with a nice smile.
The Indian pondered the question for a long time, and it became painfully obvious that he did not speak Portuguese. He looked young, probably not yet 20, and just happened to be near the river when he heard their outboard. They examined each other from 20 feet as Chevy considered his options. There was a movement in the brush behind the Indian. Along the tree line, three of his tribesmen emerged, all mercifully weaponless. Outnumbered and trespassing, Nate was ready to bolt. They weren't particularly large, but they had the home field advantage, and they weren't friendly folks, no smiles or hellos. A young female suddenly appeared from the trees and stood next to the first Indian. She, too, was brown and bare-chested, and Nate tried not to stare.
"Fow," she said.
Speaking slowly, Chevy explained what they were up to and asked to see their tribal leader. She translated his words and relayed them to the men, who huddled and talked grimly among themselves.
"Some want to eat us now," Chevy said under his breath. "Some want to wait until tomorrow."
"Very funny." When the men finished their deliberations, they reported to the woman. She then told the intruders that they must wait by the river, while news of their arrival was duly reported to the higher-ups. This suited Nate just fine, but Chevy was a bit perturbed by it. He asked if a woman missionary lived with them.
"You must wait," she said.
The Indians vanished into the woods.
"What do you think?" Nate asked when they were gone.
Neither he nor Chevy had moved an inch. They stood in grass ankle-high and looked at the trees, thick woods from which Nate was certain they were being watched.
"They catch diseases from outsiders," Chevy explained. "That's why they are careful."
"I'm not touching anybody." They retreated to the boat, where Chevy busied himself by cleaning the spark plugs. Nate removed both of his shirts and inspected the contents of his makeshift waterproof pouch. The papers were still dry.
"Those papers are for the woman?" Chevy asked.
"Yes."
"Why? What has happened to her?"
The rigid rules governing client confidentiality seemed less constricting at that moment. They were life and death in practice, but sitting in a boat deep in the Pantanal with no other American even remotely near, the rules could be bent. And why not? Who could Chevy tell? What harm could come from a little gossip? Per Josh's strict instructions to Valdir, Chevy had been told only that there was an important legal matter back home that required them to find Rachel Lane.
"Her father died a few weeks ago. He left her a lot of money."
"How much?"
"Several billion."
"Billion?"
"That's right."
"He was very wealthy."
"Yes, he was." "Did he have other children?"
"Six, I think."
"Did he give them several billion?"
"No,
he gave them very little."
"Why did he give her so much?"
"No one knows. It was a surprise."
"Does she know her father is dead?"
"No."
Did she love her father?
I doubt it. She was illegitimate. It looks as though she tried to run away from him and from everything else. Wouldn't you say so?
Nate waved his arm at the Pantanal as he said this.
Yes. It's a very good place to hide.
Did he know where she was when he died?
Not exactly. He knew she was a missionary working with the Indians somewhere around here.
Chevy ignored the spark plug in his hand and absorbed the news. He had many questions. The lawyer's breach of confidentiality was growing wider.
Why would he leave such a fortune to a child who didn't love him?
Maybe he was crazy. He jumped out of a window. This was more than Chevy could handle at one moment. He squinted his eyes and looked at the river, deep in thought. Chapter 24 The Indians were Guato, long-time residents who lived like their ancestors and preferred no contact with outsiders. They grew their food in small patches, fished the rivers, and hunted with bows and arrows. Evidently, they were a deliberate people. After an hour, Chevy smelled smoke. He climbed a tree near the boat, and when he was 40 feet up, he saw the roofs of their huts. He asked Nate to join him. Nate had not been in a tree in 40 years, but at the moment there was nothing else to do. He made the climb with less ease than Chevy, and finally came to rest on a frail branch. He hugged the trunk with one arm. They could see the tops of 3 huts, thick straw laid in neat rows. The blue smoke rose between 2 of the huts from a point they couldn't see. Could he be that close to Rachel Lane? Was she there now, listening to her people and deciding what to do? Would she send a warrior to fetch them, or would she herself simply walk through the woods and say hello?
It's a small settlement, Nate said, trying not to move.
There could be more huts.
What do you think they're doing?
Talking? Just talking?
Well, I hate to bring this up, but we need to make a move. We left the boat 8.5 hours ago. I'd like to see Welly before dark.
No problem. We'll go back with the current. Plus, I know the way. It'll be much faster.
You're not worried.
Chevy shook his head, as if he hadn't given a thought to shooting down the Cabisha in the dark. Nate certainly had. Of particular concern were the 2 large lakes they had encountered, each with various tributaries, all of which appeared identical in the daylight. His plan was to simply say hello to Ms. Lane, give her a bit of history, cover the required legalities, show her the paperwork, answer the basic questions, get her signature, thank her, and complete the meeting as soon as possible. He was worried about the time of day, and the sputtering motor, and the trip back to the Santa Laura. She would probably want to talk. Or maybe she wouldn't. Maybe she would say very little and want them to leave and never come back. Back on the ground, he had settled into the boat for a nap when Chevy saw the Indians. He said something and pointed, and Nate looked at the woods. They slowly approached the river, in a line behind their leader, the oldest Guato they'd seen so far. He was stocky with an ample belly, and he carried a long stick of some sort. It didn't appear to be sharp or dangerous. It had pretty feathers near the tip, and Nate surmised that it was probably just a ceremonial spear. The leader quickly sized up the 2 intruders and directed his comments at Chevy. "Why are you here?" he asked in Portuguese. His face wasn't friendly, but there was no aggression in his presence. Nate studied the spear. "We are looking for an American missionary, a woman," Chevy explained. "Where are you from?" the chief asked this while glancing at Nate.
"Corumbá."
"And him?" all eyes were on Nate. "He's an American. He needs to find the woman. Why does he need to find the woman?" It was the first hint that the Indians might know of Rachel Lane. Was she hiding back there somewhere in the village or maybe in the woods listening? Chevy went through a windy narrative explaining how Nate had traveled great distances and almost lost his life. It was an important matter among the Americans, nothing he, Chevy, nor the Indians would ever understand. "Is she in danger?" "No, none."
She is not here.
He says she's not here, Chevy said to Nate.
Tell him I think he's a lying bastard, Nate said softly.
I don't think so.
Have you ever seen a woman missionary around here, Chevy asked. The leader shook his head. No. Have you ever heard of one? At first there was no response. His eyes narrowed as he stared at Chevy, sizing him up as if to say, can this man be trusted? Then a slight nod. Where is she? Chevy asked. With another tribe. Where? He said he wasn't sure, but he began pointing anyway. Somewhere off to the north and west, he said, with his spear waving across half the Pantanal.
Guato? Chevy asked.
He frowned and shook his head, as if she lived among undesirables.
Ipicas, he said with scorn.
How far away?
A day.
Chevy attempted to pin him down on the time, but soon learned that hours meant nothing to the Indians. A day wasn't 24 hours, and it wasn't 12. It was simply a day. He tried the concept of half a day and made progress.
12 to 15 hours, he said to Nate.
But that's in one of those little canoes, right? Nate whispered.
Yes.
So how fast can we get there?
3 or 4 hours, if we can find it.
Chevy retrieved 2 maps and spread them on the grass. The Indians were very curious. They squatted close to their leader. To find out where they were going, they first had to determine where they were. And this took a bad turn when the leader informed Chevy that the river that brought them in was not in fact the Cabija. They had taken a wrong turn at some point after meeting the fishermen and stumbled onto the Guato. Chevy took the news hard and whispered it to Nate. Nate took it even harder. He was trusting Chevy with his life. Fancy colored navigational maps meant little to the Indians. They were soon ignored as Chevy began drawing his own. He started with the unnamed river lying before them, and chatting constantly with the chief, slowly made his way to the north. The chief received input from 2 young men. The 2, he explained to Chevy, were excellent fishermen and traveled occasionally to the Paraguay.
Hire them, Nate whispered.
Chevy tried, but in the course of negotiations learned that the 2 had never seen the Ipecas, didn't particularly want to, didn't know exactly where they were, and didn't understand the concept of working and getting paid for it. Plus, the chief didn't want them to leave. The route went from one river to the next, twisting northward, until the chief and his fishermen could no longer agree on where to go next. Chevy compared his drawing to his maps.
We found her, he said to Nate.
Where?
There's a settlement of Ipecas here, he said, pointing to a map, south of Puerto Indio, at the edge of the mountains. Their directions take us close to it.
Nate leaned lower and examined the markings.
How do we get there? I think we go back to the boat and go north a half a day on the Paraguay. Then we use the little boat again to get to the settlement.
The Paraguay looped relatively close to their target, and traveling to it on the Santa Laura struck Nate as a splendid idea.
How many hours in the little boat? Nate asked.
4, more or less.
More or less covered everything in Brazil. The distance, though, looked less than what they had covered since early morning.
Then what are we waiting for? Nate asked, standing and smiling at the Indians.
Chevy began saying thanks to their hosts while folding his maps. Now that they were leaving, the Indians loosened up and wanted to be hospitable. They offered food, which Chevy declined. He explained that they were suddenly in a hurry since they planned to return to the big river before dark. Nate grinned at them as he backtracked to the river. They wanted to see the boat. They stood at the edge of the water, watching with great curiosity as Chevy adjusted the motor. When he started it, they took a step back. The river, whatever it was named, looked entirely different going in the other direction. As they approached the first bend, Nate glanced over his shoulder and saw the Guato still standing in the water. The time was almost 4 p.m. With luck, they could make it past the large lakes before dark, then onto the Cabija. Welly would be waiting with beans and rice. As Nate did these quick calculations, he felt the first raindrops.
The flaw in the motor was not dirty spark plugs. It shut down completely 50 minutes into the return leg. The boat drifted with the current while Chevy removed the cover and attacked the carburetor with a screwdriver. Nate asked if he could help and was quickly informed that he could not, at least not with the engine. He could, however, take a bucket and begin dipping out the rainwater. And he could take a paddle and keep them in the center of the river, whatever it was named. He did both. The current kept them moving, although at a much slower pace than Nate preferred. The rain was intermittent. The river grew shallow as they approached a sharp curve, but Chevy was too busy to notice. The boat gained speed, and the rapid shoved it toward a thicket of dense brush. "I need some help here," Nate said. Chevy grabbed a paddle. He turned the boat so the bow would hit and it wouldn't flip. "Hold on," he said as they rammed into the thicket. Vines and branches flew around Nate, and he fought them with his paddle. A small snake dropped into the boat just over Nate's shoulder. He didn't see it. Chevy scooped it up with his paddle and flung it into the river. It was best not to mention it. They battled the current for a few minutes as well as battling each other. Nate somehow managed to push water in all the wrong directions. His enthusiasm for paddling kept the boat precariously close to rolling. When they were free again, away from the brush and the wildlife, Chevy confiscated both paddles and found a new job for Nate. He asked him to stand over the motor, holding his poncho wide to keep the rain off the carburetor. So Nate hovered, sort of like an angel, with his arms spread, one foot on a gas tank, one foot on the side of the boat, frozen with fear. 20 minutes dragged by as they drifted aimlessly down the narrow river. The Phelan estate could purchase every shiny new outboard motor in Brazil, and here Nate was watching an amateur mechanic try to patch one that was older than he was. Chevy bolted the top on it, then worked with the throttle for an eternity. He yanked the starter rope as Nate found himself saying a prayer. On the fourth pull, the miracle happened. The engine howled, though not as smoothly as before. It missed and sputtered, and Chevy adjusted throttle cables without much luck. "We'll have to go slower," he reported without looking at Nate. "Fine, as long as we know where we are." "No problem." The storm crept over the mountains of Bolivia, then roared into the Pantanal, much like the one that had almost killed them in the airplane. Nate was sitting low in the boat under the safety of his poncho, watching the river to the east, searching for something familiar, when he felt the first gust of wind. And the rain suddenly fell harder. He slowly turned and looked behind him. Chevy had already seen it, but said nothing. The sky was dark gray, almost black. Clouds boiled low to the ground, so that the mountains could not be seen. The rain began to drench them. Nate felt completely exposed and helpless. There was nowhere to hide, no safe harbor to dock at and ride out the storm. There was nothing but water around them, water for miles in all directions. They were in the middle of a flood, with only the tops of the brush and a few trees to guide them through the rivers and swamps. They would stay in the boat, because they had no choice. A gale swept in behind them, driving the boat forward as the rain pelted their backs. The sky darkened. Nate wanted to curl up under his aluminum bench, clutch his floatable cushion, and hide as much as possible under his poncho. But the water was accumulating around his feet. The supplies were getting wet. He took his bucket and began shoveling rainwater. They came to a fork that Nate was certain they had not passed earlier, then to a junction of rivers they could barely see through the rain. Chevy reduced the throttle to survey the waters, then hit the gas and took a sharp right as if he knew precisely where he was going. Nate was convinced they were lost. After a few minutes, the river disappeared into a thicket of rotted trees, a memorable sight they had not seen earlier. Chevy quickly turned the boat around. Now they raced into the storm, and it was a terrifying sight. The sky was black. The current was churning with whitecaps. Back at the junction, they talked for a moment, shouting through the wind and rain, then selected another river. Just before dark, they passed through a large flooded plain, a temporary lake that looked vaguely similar to the place where they'd found the fisherman in the weeds. He wasn't around. Jevy selected a tributary, one of several, and proceeded as if he navigated this corner of the Pantanal every day. Then lightning came, and for a while they could almost see where they were going. The rain slackened. The storm was slowly leaving them. Jevy stopped the motor and studied the edges of the river.
"What are you thinking?" Nate asked. There had been very little conversation during the storm. They were lost, that much was certain. But Nate would not force Jevy to admit it.
"We should make camp," Jevy said.
It was more of a suggestion than a plan.
"Why?"
"Because we have to sleep somewhere."
"We can take turns napping in the boat," Nate said. "It's safer here." He said this with the confidence of a seasoned river guide.
"Maybe. But I think we should stop here. We might get lost if we keep going in the dark."
"We've been lost for 3 hours," Nate wanted to say. Jevy guided the boat to a bank with some growth. They drifted downriver, staying close to the shore and watching the shallow waters with their flashlights. Two little red dots glowing just above the surface meant an alligator was watching too, but thankfully they saw none. They anchored by tying a guide rope to a limb 10 feet from the bank. Dinner was semi-dry saltines, canned little fish that Nate had never experienced, bananas and cheese. When the winds stopped, the mosquitoes arrived. Repellent was passed back and forth. Nate rubbed it on his neck and face, even his eyelids and his hair. The tiny bugs were quick and vicious, and moved in small black clouds from one end of the boat to the other. Though the rain had stopped, neither man removed his poncho. The mosquitoes tried fiercely, but they could not penetrate the plastic. Around 11 p.m., the sky cleared somewhat, but there was no moon. The current gently rocked the boat. Jevy offered to hold the first watch, and Nate tried his best to get comfortable enough to doze. He propped his head on the tent and stretched his legs. A gap opened in his poncho, and a dozen mosquitoes rushed forth, chewing him at the waist. Something splashed, perhaps a reptile. The aluminum boat was not designed for reclining. Sleep was out of the question. Chapter 25 Flo, Zadel, and Thetian, the three psychiatrists who had examined Troy Phelan only weeks earlier and had presented the unified opinion, both on video and later in long affidavits, that he was of sound mind, were fired. Not only were they fired, they were rebuked by the Phelan lawyers as nuts, even crackpots. New psychiatrists were found. Hark bought the first one at $300 an hour. He found him in a magazine for trial lawyers in the classifieds, among the ads for everything from accident reconstructionists to X-ray analysts. He was Dr. Sabo, retired from active practice and now willing to sell his testimony. One brief look at the behavior of Mr. Phelan, and he ventured the preliminary opinion that he clearly lacked testamentary capacity. Jumping from a window was not the act of a clear and lucid mind, and leaving an $11 billion fortune to an unknown heir was evidence of a deeply disturbed person. Sabo relished the idea of working on the Phelan case. Refuting the opinions of the first three psychiatrists would be challenging. The publicity was seductive. He'd never had a famous case. And the money would pay for a trip to the Orient. All of the Phelan lawyers were scrambling to undo the testimony of Flo, Zadel, and Thetian. The only way to discredit them was to find new experts with new opinions. Fat hourly rates yielded to contingencies. The heirs wouldn't be able to pay the hefty monthly fees they were about to incur, so their lawyers graciously agreed to simplify matters by taking percentages. The range was staggering, though no firm would ever divulge its cut. Hark wanted 40%, but Rex berated him for his greediness. They finally agreed on 25%. Grit squeezed 25% out of Mary Ross Phelan Jackman. The clear victor was Wally Bright, the street fighter, who insisted on an even deal with Libigale and Spike. He would get half of their settlement. In the mad scramble before they filed their suits, not a single Phelan heir asked if they were doing the right thing. They trusted their lawyers, and besides, everybody else was contesting the will. No one could afford to be left out. There was so much at stake. Because Hark had been the loudest of the Phelan lawyers, he caught the attention of Sneed, Troy's longtime gopher. No one had noticed Sneed in the aftermath of the suicide. He'd been forgotten in the stampede to the courthouse. His employment had been terminated. And when the will was read, Sneed himself was sitting in the courtroom, his face disguised with sunglasses and a hat, recognized by no one. He had left in tears. He hated the Phelan children because Troy hated them. Over the years, Sneed had been forced to do all sorts of unpleasant things to protect Troy from his families. Sneed had arranged abortions and had bribed cops when the boys were caught with drugs. He had lied to the wives to protect the mistresses, and when the mistresses became wives, then poor Sneed lied to them, too, to protect the girlfriends. In return for his good work, the children and wives had called him a fag. And in return for a career of faithful service, Mr. Phelan left him nothing. Not a cent. He'd been paid well over the years and had some money in mutuals, but not enough to survive on. He had sacrificed everything for his job and his master. He'd been denied a normal life because Mr. Phelan expected him to be on duty every hour of the day. A family had been out of the question. He had no real friends to speak of. Mr. Phelan had been his friend, his confidant, the only person Sneed could trust. Over the years, there had been many promises made by the old man about taking care of Sneed. He knew for a fact that he'd been named in one will. He'd seen the document himself. He would inherit $1 million upon Mr. Phelan's death. At the time, Troy had a net worth of $3 billion, and Sneed remembered thinking how small $1 million seemed. As the old man got richer, Sneed imagined his own bequest growing with each will. He'd occasionally asked about the matter. Subtle, gentle inquiries made it just the right moments, he thought. But Mr. Phelan had cursed him and threatened to cut him out completely. "You're as bad as my children," he had said, crushing poor Sneed. Somehow he'd gone from $1 million to zero, and he was bitter about it. He would be forced to join the enemies simply because he had no choice. He found the new office of Hark Geddes and Associates near DuPont Circle. The receptionist explained that Mr. Geddes was very busy. "So am I," Sneed replied rudely. Because he'd been so close to Troy, he had spent most of his life around lawyers. They were always busy. "Give him this," he said, handing her an envelope. "It's quite urgent. I'll wait over there for 10 minutes, then I'll walk down the street to the next law office." Sneed took a seat and stared at the floor. Cheap new carpet. The receptionist hesitated for a moment, then disappeared through a door. The envelope held a small handwritten note that read, "I worked for Troy Phelan for 30 years. I know everything. Malcolm Sneed." Hark appeared in a flash, holding the note, smiling goofily as if friendliness would impress Sneed. They practically ran down the hall to a large office, the receptionist behind them. No, Sneed did not want coffee, tea, water, or a cola. Hark slammed the door and locked it. The office smelled of fresh paint. The desk and shelves were new and the woods didn't match. Boxes of files and junk were stacked along the walls. Sneed took his time examining the details. "Just move in?" he said. "Couple of weeks ago." Sneed hated the place, and he wasn't sure about the lawyer either. He wore a cheap wool suit, much less expensive than the one Sneed was wearing. 30 years, huh?" Hark said, still holding the note. "That's right." "Were you with him when he jumped?" "No, he jumped alone." A fake laugh, then the smile returned. "I mean, were you in the room?" Yes, I almost caught him. Must have been terrible. It was. Still is.
Did you see him sign the will? The last one?
I did.
Did you see him write the damned thing?
Sneed was perfectly prepared to lie. The truth meant nothing because the old man had lied to him. What was there to lose?
I saw a lot of things, he said. And I know a lot more. This visit is about nothing but money. Mr. Phelan promised that he would take care of me in his will. There were many promises, all broken.
So you're in the same boat as my client, Hark said.
I hope not. I despise your client and his miserable siblings. Let's get that straight on the front end.
I think it's straight.
No one was closer to Troy Phelan than I. I saw and heard things no one else can testify to.
So you want to be a witness?
I am a witness, an expert, and I'm very expensive.
Their eyes locked for a second. The message was delivered and received.
The law says that laymen cannot render opinions as to the mental capacity of one executing a will, but you can certainly testify as to specific acts and deeds that prove an unsound mind. I know all this, Sneed said rudely.
Was he crazy?
He was or he wasn't. Doesn't matter to me. I can go either way.
Hark had to stop and contemplate this. He scratched his face and studied the wall.
Sneed decided to help him. This is the way I see it. Your boy got screwed, along with his brother and sisters. They each got $5 million when they turned 21, and we know what they did with the money. Since they're all heavily in debt, they have no choice but to contest the will. No jury's gonna feel sorry for them, though. They're a bunch of greedy losers. It'll be a tough case to win. But you and the other legal eagles will attack the will, and you'll create this huge mess of a lawsuit that quickly gets in the tabloids because there's $11 billion at stake. Since you don't have much of a case, you hope for a settlement before you go to trial.
You catch on quick.
No, I watched Mr. Phelan for 30 years. Anyway, the size of your settlement depends on me. If my recall is clear and detailed, and perhaps my old boss lacked testamentary capacity when he wrote the will.
Then your memory comes and goes.
My memory is whatever I want it to be. There's no one to question it.
What do you want?
Money.
How much?
$5 million.
That's a lot.
It's nothing. I'll take it from this side or the other. It doesn't matter.
How am I supposed to get $5 million to you?
Don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I figure you and your cronies can conjure up some dirty little plan.
There was a long pause as Hark began the conjuring. He had a lot of questions, but suspected he wouldn't get a lot of answers. At least not now.
Any more witnesses? He asked. Only one. Her name is Nicolette. She was Mr. Phelan's last secretary.
How much does she know?
Depends. She can be bought.
You've already talked to her.
Every day. We're a package.
How much for her?
She'll be covered in the $5 million.
A real bargain. Anybody else?
No one of consequence.
Hark closed his eyes and massaged both temples. I don't object to your $5 million, he said, pinching his nose. I just don't know how we can funnel it to you.
Oh, I'm sure you'll think of something.
Give me some time, okay? I need to think about this.
I'm in no hurry. I'll give you a week. If you say no, then I'll go to the other side.
There is no other side.
Don't be so certain.
You know something about Rachel Lane?
I know everything, Sneed said, then left the office.
Chapter 26. The first streaks of dawn brought no surprises. They were tied to a tree at the edge of a small river that looked like all the others they'd seen. The clouds were heavy again. The light of day came slowly. Breakfast was a small box of cookies, the last of the rations Welly had packed for them. Nate ate slowly, wondering with each bite when he might eat again. The current was strong, so they drifted with it as the sun rose. The only sound was the rush of the water. They were conserving gas and delaying the moment when Chevy would be forced to try and start the motor. They drifted into a flooded area where three streams met and for a few moments sat in the stillness.
"I guess we're lost, aren't we?" Nate said. "I know exactly where we are."
"Where?"
"We're in the Pantanal, and all rivers run to the Paraguay.
Eventually."
"Yes, eventually."
Chevy removed the top cover of the motor and wiped the moisture from the carburetor. He adjusted the throttle, checked the oil, then tried to start the motor. On the fifth pull, the motor caught and sputtered, then quit.
"I will die here," Nate said to himself. "I'll either drown, starve, or be eaten, but it is here, in this immense swamp, that I will breathe my last."
To their surprise, they heard a shout. The voice was high, like that of a young girl. The sputtering of the motor had attracted the attention of another human. The voice came from a weedy marsh along the bank of a converging stream. Chevy yelled, and a few seconds later the voice yelled back. A kid of no more than 15 came through the weeds in a tiny canoe, hand-carved from the trunk of a tree. With a homemade paddle, he cut through the water with amazing ease and speed.
"Bom dia,"
he said with a wide smile. The little face was brown and square, and probably the most beautiful Nate had seen in years. He threw a rope, and the two boats were attached. A long, lazy conversation ensued, and after a while Nate was agitated. "What's he saying?" he snapped at Chevy. The kid looked at Nate, and Chevy said,
"Americano." "He says we're a great distance from the Cabisha River," Chevy said.
"I could have told you that."
"He says the Paraguay is a half a day to the east."
"By canoe, right?"
"No, by plane."
"Funny. How long will it take us?"
4 hours, more or less."
5, maybe 6 hours. And that was with a properly running motor. It would take a week if they were forced to paddle. The Portuguese resumed in no particular hurry. The canoe was empty except for a roll of fishing line wrapped around a tin can, and a jar of mud, Nate assumed, contained worms or some type of bait. What did he know about fishing? He scratched his mosquito bites. A year ago, he'd been skiing in Utah with the boys. The drink of the day had been some type of tequila concoction, which typically Nate consumed with gusto until he passed out. The hangover had lasted for 2 days. There was a flourish in the chatter, and suddenly they were pointing. Chevy looked at him as he spoke.
"What is it?" Nate asked.
"The Indians are not far away."
"How far?"
1 hour, maybe 2.
"Can he take us there?"
"I know the way."
"I'm sure you do, but I'd feel better if he'd tag along."
It was a slight affront to Chevy's pride, but under the circumstances he could not argue.
"He may want a little money."
"Whatever. If the kid only knew. The Phelan estate on one side of the table, and this skinny little Pantaneiro on the other." Nate smiled at the mental picture. "How about a fleet of canoes, with rods and reels and depth finders? Just name it, son, and it's yours."
"10 reais, Chevy said after brief negotiations.
"Fine. For about $10 they would be delivered to Rachel Lane." A plan was devised. Chevy tilted the outboard so that the prop was out of the water, and they began paddling. They followed the boy in the canoe for 20 minutes until they entered a small, shallow stream with rapid currents. Nate withdrew his paddle, caught his breath, and wiped sweat from his face. His heart was pounding and his muscles were already tired. The clouds were breaking up, so the sun was bearing down. Chevy went to work on the motor. Luckily it started and kept running, and they followed the boy, his canoe easily outpacing them and their sputtering outboard. It was almost one when they found the higher ground. The floodwaters gradually disappeared so that the rivers were lined with thick brush and the trees were dense. The kid was somber and, oddly, concerned with the position of the sun. "Just up there," he told Chevy, "just around the bend." He seemed afraid to go further. "I'll stop here," he said. "I need to return home." Nate handed him the money, and they thanked him. He headed back with the current and disappeared quickly. They plowed ahead, the outboard halting and struggling at half speed, but getting them there nonetheless. The river ran into a forest where the trees hung low over the water, so low that they weaved together above and formed a tunnel that blocked out light. It was dark, and the uneven hum of their motor resounded from the banks. Nate had the eerie suspicion that they were being watched. He could almost feel the arrows being aimed at him. He braced for an attack of deadly blow darts hurled at him by savages dressed in war paint and trained to kill anyone with a white face. But they saw children first, happy little brown bodies splashing in the water. The tunnel ended near a settlement. The mothers were bathing too, just as completely naked as their children, and thoroughly unconcerned about it. At first they retreated to the bank when they saw the John boat. Chevy killed the engine and began talking and smiling as they drifted in. An older girl ran away in the direction of the settlement. "Fala Portugues?" Chevy asked the crowd of four women and seven children. They just stared. The smaller ones hid behind their mothers. The women were short, with thick bodies and small breasts. "Are they friendly?" Nate asked.
"The man will tell us."
The men arrived within minutes, three of them, also short, thick, and muscular. Thankfully, their privates were covered with small leather pouches. The oldest one claimed to speak Chevy's language, but his Portuguese was rudimentary at best. Nate stayed in the boat, where things appeared to be safe, while Chevy leaned on a tree near the water and tried to make himself understood. The Indians crowded around Chevy, who was a foot taller than the men. After a few minutes of repetition and hand gestures, Nate said, "Translation, please." The Indians looked at Nate.
"Americano,"
Chevy explained, and another conversation ensued. "What about the woman?" Nate asked.
"We haven't gotten that far yet. I'm still trying to convince them not to burn you alive."
"Try harder." More Indians arrived. Their huts were visible 100 yards away, near the edge of a forest. Upriver, a half-dozen canoes were tied to the bank. The children became bored. They slowly left their mothers and waded close to the boat to inspect it. They were also intrigued by the man with the white face. Nate smiled and winked and before long got a grin. If Wally hadn't been so damn cheap with the cookies, Nate would have had something to share with them. The conversation poked along. The Indian doing the talking would periodically turn to his pals and make a report, and inevitably his words caused great concern. Their language was a series of primal grunts and strains, all delivered with as little lip movement as possible.
"What's he saying?" Nate growled.
"I don't know," Chevy replied.
A little boy placed his hand on the edge of the boat and studied Nate with black pupils as big as quarters. Very softly he said,
"Hello."
Nate knew they were in the right place. No one heard the boy but Nate. He leaned forward and softly said,
"Hello." "Goodbye,"
the boy said without moving. Rachel had taught him at least 2 English words.
"What is your name?"
Nate asked, his voice a whisper.
"Hello,"
he repeated. Under the tree, the translating was making the same progress. The male Indians were huddling in animated conversation while the women said nothing.
"What about the woman?" Nate repeated.
"I asked. They have no answer."
"What does that mean?"
"I'm not sure. I think she's here, but they're reluctant for some reason."
Why would they be reluctant? Chevy frowned and looked away. How was he supposed to know? They talked some more, then the Indians left en masse, men first, then the women, then the children. They trooped single file to the settlement, disappearing from view.
Did you make them mad?
No, they want to have a meeting of some kind.
Do you think she's here?
I think so.
Chevy took his seat in the boat and prepared himself for a nap. It was almost 1 in whatever time zone they happened to be in. Lunch was over and done with, without so much as a soggy saltine. The hike began around 3. They were led by a small group of young men away from the river, along the dirt path to the village, through the huts where everyone stood still and watched, then away again, along another path into the woods. "It's a death march," thought Nate. "They're taking us into the jungle for some Stone Age blood ritual." He followed Chevy, who loped along in a confident gait.
"Where the hell are we going?"
he hissed, like a prisoner of war afraid to offend his captors.
"Relax."
The woods opened to a clearing, and they were near the river again. The leader suddenly stopped and pointed. At the edge of the water, an anaconda stretched in the sun. He was black, with yellow markings on his underside. His girth was at least 1 foot at its widest.
"How long is he?" Nate asked.
6 or 7 meters. "Finally, you see an anaconda," Chevy said.
Nate's knees buckled and his mouth was dry. He had been joking about the snakes. The sight of a real one, long and massive, was truly amazing.
"Some Indians worship snakes," Chevy said.
"Then what are our missionaries doing?" Nate thought. He would ask Rachel about this practice. The mosquitoes seemed to bother only him. The Indians were immune. Chevy never swatted. Nate slapped his own flesh and scratched until he drew blood. His repellent was in the boat, along with his tent and machete and everything else he owned at the moment, no doubt being examined by the children. The hike was adventurous for the first half hour. Then the heat and the insects made things monotonous.
"How far are we going?" Nate asked, not really expecting an answer with any accuracy.
Chevy said something to the point man, who said something in return.
"Not far," came the reply.
They crossed another trail, then a wider one. There was traffic in the area. Soon they saw the first hut, then smelled smoke. When they were 200 yards away, the leader pointed to a shaded area near the river. Nate and Chevy were led to a bench made of hollow cane poles lashed together with string. They were left there with 2 guards while the others reported to the village. As time passed, the 2 guards grew weary and decided to take a nap. They leaned against the trunk of a tree and were soon asleep.
"I guess we could escape," Nate said.
"To where? Are you hungry?"
"Sort of, are you?"
"No, I'm stuffed," Nate said. "I ate 7 thin cookies 9 hours ago. Remind me to slap Welly when I see him."
"I hope he is okay."
"Why shouldn't he be? He's swinging in my hammock, drinking fresh coffee, safe and dry and well-fed."
They wouldn't have brought them this far if Rachel wasn't nearby. As Nate rested on the bench and stared at the tops of the huts in the distance, he had many questions about her. He was curious about her appearance. Her mother was supposed to have been a beautiful woman. Troy Phelan had a good eye for women. What kind of clothes would she wear? The Ipika she ministered to were naked. How long since she'd seen civilization? Was he the first American to ever visit the village? How would she react to his presence? And to the money? As time dragged along, Nate became more anxious about meeting her. Both of the guards were asleep when there was movement from the settlement. Chevy tossed a pebble at them and whistled quietly. They jumped to their feet and resumed their positions. The weeds along the trail were knee-high, and in the distance they could see a patrol moving their way along the path. Rachel was with them. She was coming. There was a light yellow shirt in the midst of the brown-skinned chests, and a lighter face under a straw hat. From 100 yards, Nate could see her.
"We found our girl," he said.
"Yes, I think we have."
They took their time. 3 young men were in front and 3 behind. She was slightly taller than the Indians and carried herself with an easy elegance. She could have been out for a walk among the flowers. There was no hurry. Nate watched every step. She was very slender, with wide, bony shoulders. She began looking in their direction as they grew closer. Nate and Jevy stood to meet her. The Indian stopped at the edge of the shade, but Rachel kept walking. She removed her hat. Her hair was brown and half-gray and very short. She stopped a few feet from Jevy and Nate.
"Bo tarde, señor," she said to Jevy, then looked at Nate.
Her eyes were dark blue, almost indigo. No wrinkles, no makeup. She was 42 years old and aging quite well, with the soft glow of one who knew little stress.
"Boa tarde."
She didn't offer to shake hands, nor did she give her name. The next move belonged to them. "My name is Nate O'Reilly. I'm an attorney from Washington."
"And you?" she said to Jevy.
"I'm Jevy Cardozo from Corumbá. I'm his guide."
She looked them up and down with a slight grin. The moment was not at all unpleasant for her. She was enjoying the encounter.
"What brings you here?"
she asked. It was American English, with no accent, no trace of Louisiana or Montana, just the flat, precise, inflectionless English from Sacramento or St. Louis.
"We heard the fishing was good," Nate said.
No response.
"He makes bad jokes," Jevy said, apologizing.
"Sorry. I'm looking for Rachel Lane. I have reason to believe you and she are one and the same." She absorbed this without changing expressions.
"Why do you want to find Rachel Lane?"
"Because I'm a lawyer and my firm has an important legal matter with Rachel Lane."
"What kind of legal matter?"
"I can tell no one but her."
"I'm not Rachel Lane. I'm sorry."
Jevy sighed, and Nate's shoulders slumped. She saw every movement, every reaction, every twitch.
"Are you hungry?" she asked them.
They both nodded. She called the Indians and gave them instructions.
"Jevy," she said, "go with these men into the village. They will feed you and give you enough food for Mr. O'Reilly here."
They sat on the bench in the darkening shade, watching in silence as the Indians took Jevy to the village. He turned around once, just to make sure Nate was okay. Chapter 27 She didn't seem as tall away from the Indians, and she had avoided whatever the women ate that made them thick. Her legs were thin and long. She wore leather sandals, which seemed odd in a culture where no one had shoes. Where did she get them? And where did she get her yellow short-sleeved shirt and khaki shorts? Oh, the questions he had. Her clothing was simple and well-worn. If she wasn't Rachel Lane, then surely she knew where Rachel was. Their knees almost touched.
"Rachel Lane ceased to exist many years ago," she said, gazing at the village in the distance. "I kept the name Rachel, but dropped the Lane. It must be serious, or you wouldn't be here."
She spoke softly and slowly, no syllable missed, and each carefully weighed. "Troy's dead. He killed himself 3 weeks ago. She lowered her head slightly, closed her eyes, and appeared to be praying. It was a brief prayer followed by a long pause. Silence didn't bother her.
"Did you know him?" she finally asked.
"I met him once years ago. Our firm has many lawyers, and I personally never worked on Troy's business. No, I didn't know him."
"Neither did I.
He was my earthly father, and I spent many hours praying for him, but he was always a stranger.
When did you last see him? Nate's words, too, were softer and slower. She had a soothing effect.
Many years ago, before I went to college. How much do you know about me?
Not much. You don't leave much of a trail.
Then, how did you find me?
Troy helped. He tried to find you before he died, but couldn't. He knew you were a missionary with world tribes, and that you were in this general part of the world. The rest was up to me.
How could he have known that?
He had an awful lot of money.
And that's why you're here?
Yes, that's why I'm here. We need to talk business.
Troy must have left me something in his will.
You could say that.
I don't want to talk business. I want to chat. Do you know how often I hear English?
Rarely, I would imagine.
I go to Korumba once a year for supplies. I phone the home office, and for about 10 minutes, I speak English. It's always frightening.
Why?
I'm nervous. My hands shake as I hold the phone. I know the people I'm talking to, but I'm afraid I will use the wrong words. Sometimes I even stutter. 10 minutes a year.
You're doing a fine job now.
I'm very nervous.
Relax, I'm a swell guy.
But you found me. I was seeing a patient just an hour ago when the boys came to tell me that an American was here. I ran to my hut and started praying. God gave me strength.
I come in peace for all mankind.
You seem like a nice man.
If you only knew, thought Nate. Thanks. You, said something about seeing a patient.
Yes.
I thought you were a missionary.
I am. I'm also a doctor.
And Nate's specialty was suing doctors. It was neither the time nor the place for a discussion about medical malpractice. That's not in my research.
I changed my name after college, before med school and seminary. That's probably where the trail ended.
Exactly. Why did you change your name?
It's complicated. At least it was then. It doesn't seem important now.
A breeze settled in from the river. It was almost 5. The clouds over the forest were dark and low. She saw him glance at his watch.
The boys are bringing your tent here. This is a good place to sleep tonight.
Thanks, I guess. We'll be safe, won't we?
Yes. God will protect you. Say your prayers.
At that moment, Nate planned to pray like a preacher. The proximity to the river was of particular concern. He could shut his eyes and see that anaconda slithering up to his tent.
You do pray, don't you, Mr. O'Reilly?
Please call me Nate. Yes, I pray.
Are you Irish?
I'm a mutt. More German than anything else. My father had Irish ancestors. Family history has never interested me.
What church do you attend?
Episcopal. Catholic, Lutheran, Episcopal, it didn't matter. Nate hadn't seen the inside of a church since his second wedding. His spiritual life was a subject he preferred to avoid. Theology was not his long suit, and he didn't want to discuss it with a missionary. She paused, as usual, and he changed directions. Are these Indians peaceful?
For the most part. The Ipecas are not warriors, but they do not trust white people.
What about you?
I've been here 11 years. They have accepted me.
How long did it take?
I was lucky, because there was a missionary couple here before me. They had learned the language and translated the New Testament. And I'm a doctor. I made friends fast when I helped the women through childbirth.
Your Portuguese sounded pretty good.
I'm fluent. I speak Spanish, Ipica, and Machigenga. What is that?
The Machigenga are natives in the mountains of Peru. I was there for 6 years. I had just become comfortable with the language when they evacuated me.
Why?
Gorillas.
As if snakes and alligators and diseases and floods weren't enough.
They kidnapped 2 missionaries in a village not far from me. But God saved them. They were released unharmed 4 years later.
Any gorillas around here?
No. This is Brazil. The people are very peaceful. There are some drug runners, but nobody comes this deep into the Pantanal.
Which brings up an interesting point. How far away is the Paraguay River?
This time of the year, 8 hours.
Brazilian hours?
She smiled at this. You've learned that time is slower here. 8 to 10 hours American time.
By canoe?
That's how we travel. I used to have a boat with a motor, but it was old and it eventually wore out.
How long does it take if you have a boat with a motor?
5 hours, more or less. It's the flood season, and it's easy to get lost.
So I've learned.
The rivers run together. You'll need to take one of the fishermen with you when you leave. There's no way you'll find the Paraguay without a guide.
And you go once a year?
Yes, but I go in the dry season, in August. It's cooler then, not as many mosquitoes.
You go alone?
No. I get Laco, my Indian friend, to travel with me to the Paraguay. It takes about 6 hours by canoe when the rivers are down. I'll wait for a boat, then catch a ride to Corumbá. I'll stay for a few days, do my business, then catch a boat back.
Nate thought of how few boats he'd seen on the Paraguay. Just any boat?
Usually a cattle boat. The captains are good about taking passengers.
She travels by canoe because her old boat wore out. She bums rides on cattle boats to visit Corumbá, her only contact with civilization. How would the money change her? Nate asked himself. The question seemed impossible to answer. He would tell her tomorrow, when the day was fresh, when he was rested and fed, and they had hours to deal with the issues. Figures appeared at the edge of the settlement, men